Be the right club. Be the right club today.
Yes! Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything different?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the No Laying Up podcast. I would introduce him as Golf Channel's Justin Ray, but he's now going over to the 15th Club to betray us and become part of Team Europe's winning Ryder Cup team. Mr. Justin Ray, welcome to the No Laying Up podcast.
Solly, long-time listener, first-time caller. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. I think it's kind of, we wanted to make nice with you before you kind of make the full transition over to the 15th Club here and turn your back on the country here. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're doing?
I mean, you know, accusing me of treason is a great way to start the interview, but
that's I like to punch people in the face a little bit and then get them back on their heels.
So, I mean, I was at Golf Channel for a little over 5 years, 15th Club, as you mentioned. You know, they do a lot of player performance stuff, getting some of the top players in the world, primarily guys from Europe, better. Rory McIlroy is their most prominent client. But they're dipping their toe more into the storytelling side of things, the media side of things. And, you know, they're in a really unique position in the industry at the crossroads of really analytics and storytelling and player performance. And it was just a perfect fit. And I'm just so excited to be part of it. It's a company that is really mobile and young and agile and is going to do a lot of really big things in the future. And I'm fired up to be part of it.
Well, I'm a big fan of all of it, except for obviously the helping of the European Ryder Cup team, which seems to be working. I want to get into some of that. But what exactly are you going to be doing? I know your role there is director of content. What does that mean? Am I creating a rival here by having you on? Are you guys competing with us in this in the podcast space? What's going on?
I mean, we can have a friendly rivalry if that's what it evolves to. I mean, I'm going to be doing a lot of stuff that, you know, folks know me for already, you know, creating numbers and identifying trends and the stats everyone knows that I do. I'm going to do a little bit more writing. It's going to be odd. The last job I had outside of TV was at a Foot Locker in college in Columbia, Missouri. So those first few days without going to a TV studio and sitting in a production meeting, it's a little bit surreal. But a lot of the same stuff. Then I'm going to want to dip my toes a little bit into the player performance side of it, helping guys out, helping them get better. But we've got a lot of exciting stuff down the pike. I wish I could divulge everything that we're doing, but it's a really exciting time for 15th Club, and we're going to grow exponentially from what we are now.
Well, I do look forward to seeing that. Why don't, you referred to it there, but kind of your background, I want to hear in your own words as to what you used to do at Golf Channel and kind of all the depth of what you do. I know people see your stats and stuff on Twitter that are very timely and always coming at the right time, but what else do you do for Golf Channel? What is your official job there?
Yeah, so I started at ESPN. I had an internship there before I graduated college. In the research department. After school, went straight there. And was at ESPN for a better part of 7 years. I was in Bristol, working in the research department, doing, you know, all sports, baseball, football, basketball, working on SportsCenter. I was privileged enough to be the researcher on Scott Van Pelt's radio show for several years, which I don't know if you can possibly have more fun in a professional setting. I went and, you know, talk sports with my buddies and laugh my ass off. And that was my job. It was unbelievable. When ESPN launched Longhorn Network, the network dedicated to University of Texas, they were like, do you want to go move? I'm from Texas. I'm not a Longhorn. I went to Missouri, but I'm from Texas. And they're like, do you want to live in Austin and get a promotion? I was like, yep, sure do. I want to get out of the snow. I'm going to be doing that. And since it's college athletics, the summers were open and I could still work on their golf coverage. So I did that until 2014. Golf Channel kind of got in touch with me, and you know, I helped kind of shape what their research department did on Golf Central and live from at the majors and players and Ryder Cup and all those big events over the last 5 years or so. And now I've been with 15th Club for about 30 hours. So it's been a wild few weeks. But you know, I've been in this space of golf stats and sports statistics and storytelling and all that stuff. I've been in the booth at the Masters, at the US Open, been on the live from sets all over and all the big events Golf Channel covers. It's an unbelievable gig. I still can't believe I get to do this for a living. But that's kind of where I'm at.
What for those, you know, you said you went straight to ESPN after college with an internship. For the listeners at home, the college kids or the high school kids that might be listening, that sounds like a pretty dreamy job. How does somebody go about getting an internship like that at ESPN?
It was unbelievable, man. So I was told that they had about 15,000, this was 2007, and I was told they had about 15,000 applicants for the research job.
Oh, my God.
And two got it, and I was one of them. So
did you know somebody? Crazy. How does that happen?
So I have a story, and it's going to be a little long-winded at first, but it'll make sense. So 2007, I've applied for the production associate internship and the research internship. So Kansas plays Missouri in a basketball game. Missouri gets crushed. Kansas destroys us. But it's the week. Do you remember the horse Barbaro?
Oh yeah.
And this is going to sound insane, but so it was the week that coverage just was wall to wall everywhere on ESPN. And me and my friends in our quasi-inebriated state that morning, making a sign for the game, scrawled out on a piece of poster board like a murderer, "Bill Self killed Barbaro," and that was our sign we brought to the Mizzou Kansas game. So John Anderson just happens to be at the game.
No way.
And he sees us from the court, points up at our sign, thinks it's hilarious, physically walks up into the stands and signs our sign and shakes our hand. It was great. It was fun. Kansas obliterated Mizzou. And, you know, it was a great memory. So a few months later, as I'm waiting for feedback from to see if I got the internship as a production associate or in research, I got an email from, after I was rejected for the PA internship, John Anderson sends a note to a handful of Mizzou people who applied and says, "Hey, nobody thought I was worth anything when I was a kid. Keep working hard." It was a really nice gesture by him, encouraging, you know, us to keep moving forward and, you know, doing our thing. So I replied to him. I was like, "I've also applied for the, thank you, John, for the nice note. I've also applied for the research internship. You may remember me. You signed my Bill Self killed Barbaro sign a few months ago." And John, in about 15 seconds, like he's sitting at his desk with Outlook open, working on SportsCenter. I'm in the library at Mizzou, and within 30 seconds, he replies to the email in all caps, "I am recommending you for the research internship based on your sign alone."
No way. I've never heard this story.
And then a couple months later, I had to go through the whole process of, you got to pass all these kind of like sports knowledge tests, and there's interviews and stuff. But that moment of lunacy and happenstance that John Anderson, you know, saw my sign and thought it was funny, helped me get my foot in my door. And essentially, it helped start my career. So,
man,
it's crazy, and it's true. And John's made me tell that story to Rick Riley like four or five times. So,
I was afraid to ask the question because I was afraid the answer was going to be like, "Oh, my dad like called in a favor or so-and-so." I remember when I was like around that age, I thought, man, if I could work in sports or do like that exact job, that would be like the happiest thing in the world. But there's no way I would ever get that job. And you laying out that math of 15,000 people applying and two getting it was kind of like, yeah, that's I felt like the deck was stacked against me. Never would have thought making a sign that says "Bill Self killed Barbaro" would have helped launch your career in sports.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, so in the months after that, I'm working in a Foot Locker part-time job in a mall when I was in college, and I'm like answering their quizzes over the phone, and, you know, they would call you and ask, like, I'd be walking between classes and like the head of research would be like, "All right, so what do you think of the secondaries in the NFC West this season? Like, who has the best bullpen in the AL East? You know, name as many Masters champions as you can since 1980. Like, you know, it's all general sports knowledge. We're the nerdiest of the nerds in sports. If you're a researcher at ESPN, there's just so much minutia that, you know, you feel like you've been trained your whole life just by being an insane sports nut like I am. But, yeah.
I guess where does that come
crazy.
From? No, where does that come from? Are you just like, did you look up numbers and stuff as a kid? I used to retype the box scores in baseball, like from when I was like 6 years old. I used to retype them the day after, like for whatever reason. I come from like this really nerdy stat background as well. I loved sabermetrics in baseball, and I really, you know, engaged in strokes gained, kind of like sabermetrics of golf. So I feel like I can kind of relate to you on a certain level. I just wanted to like, where did this kind of foundation of sports knowledge comes from?
I've just always been obsessed with it. I mean, it's one of the only things in life that has an ultimate outcome. You know, sports is, there's a winner and a loser. You don't really get that in any other facet of life, whether it's, you know, real world events or relationships or what it is. I don't know if I was drawn to that. I was always drawn to the numbers in it. I was a, my dad tells me I would sneak out and steal the Houston Chronicle sports page before he could get to the paper in the morning. So, you know, I just voraciously read that all the time. And I've been into all sports always. I mean, like, I'm an NBA league pass junkie. I always been a huge NBA guy. Love football. Grew up playing select baseball. Actually, me and Kyle Porter of CBS realized about a year ago, we grew up in Houston about the same time, and we played against each other in select baseball in the late 90s, early 2000s. Yeah, it's a small universe, man. You never know where you'll end up back at. I don't know. I was the kid who kept his baseball stats in an Excel file on his dad's computer.
Same
you know?
Exact thing.
Correct. You know, so that's kind of the way I was always wired. Every sports project was, you know, every school project was always about, you know, a golfer or baseball player or, you know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar or whatever it might be. So,
did you ever reach base via error? Because I never did. If I reached base, it was a hit when I was keeping my own statistics. So,
I was pretty generous with my earned runs as a pitcher.
Exactly. The fielders behind me let me down a lot too back in the day. I want to know a bit about kind of what your process is like, specifically, I guess, more so with golf, as to what your database looks like, and because I mean, we're all amazed at where you pull these stats from and the timeliness of it, and how you even go about looking it up. Do you just have like the mega Excel file with every, you know, PGA Tour shot ever recorded in it, or how does this work?
So over time, I've built my resources. You know, I've done this for, it's 12 years now. So over the years, I've been able to create a whole bunch of different databases based on my own manual entry, going through media guides and record books and stuff, and then also the PGA Tour is able to provide they have so much information that I spend every day of my life on the site, and I feel like I still find new stuff. So it's a combination of those two things. But like over the years, like I've built my first big project I did at ESPN in golf was a big Excel database of every major champion since the 1860 Open, and like their position by round, their age, shots back, you know, all that stuff. So that, you know, when Rory wins his fourth major at Valhalla at age 25, I click three things and I have the list of guys to do that.
Wow.
To win four majors by 25.
Just like pivot tables or what?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I'll say database, but I mean, I have a journalism degree, man. It's not like computer programming stuff. It's just a basic Excel file and, you know, knowing how to sort it and what, you know, what you're looking for and all that. And I've done that too with like PGA Tour winners, with 54 hole leaders on the PGA Tour. I have an LPGA one. I've got every top 10 in major championship history in a file. But this is taking time. It's like, you know, it's like your old man with a set of tools. You know, you don't just get the whole toolbox right away. Like you build it over, you know, over the years. You know, you don't have the whole collection right away. So, and now I'm at the point where I've got pretty much everything that, you know, that I need. You know, I try to challenge myself and come up with new things. Like the thing I'm working on right now that I'm going to have for the Masters is the strokes gained against the field for every round in Masters history. So I'll be able to tell the most accurate story about, okay, Jordan Spieth's off to an amazing start in his Masters career. Here's how it ranks in X, Y, and Z. So I'm always trying to come up with new ways to, you know, get better at my craft and get better at telling stories and, you know, giving people the numbers that they haven't seen before in golf.
A quick break here, guys, to check in with our friends from OGIO. We have not heard from them in a while on this podcast. This is a brand that has sold over 2 million backpacks per year, and they have reinvented the walking golf bag. You'll see in Tourist Sauce Season 3 that we've all got OGIO walking bags now. They're integrating industry-leading strap technology, OGIO's Shadow Fuse 304 golf bag, perfect companion for the walking golfer. If you're listening to this already on Wednesday morning, we might actually be out on the course with our walking bags at this very moment. It's got wide, dense, completely redesigned padding, self-leveling fit disc technology. The Shadow Fuse 304 golf bag delivers unparalleled walkability. If you walk a golf course, you need this golf bag. Learn more about the best straps in golf at OGIO.com/golf. Everybody knows the most important thing about a walking golf bag is the straps. And Callaway and OGIO have invested in the technology in these things, and it is the most comfortable golf bag you will have ever put on your shoulders. So without any further ado, let's get back to Justin Ray. What do you know, when there's a broadcast going on at Golf Central or you know, during an actual live event, what are you the one that kind of triggers you know, the stat process, or does somebody say to you, hey, we need to know how often this has been done, go figure it out, and you do it in 30 seconds? Or kind of what does it look like when you're live and on, kind of on the spot?
Yeah, it's kind of a combination of things. You know, if when I was with Golf Channel, if Brandel has an idea or Frank Noble has an idea, you know, I'll look something up for them, and you know, we'll come up with a way to put it together for the show. But during live action, I'm usually just looking for things that are interesting, something that's going to be, you know, relevant that we could create into a graphic or a font for the, you know, like a text on the screen. I just kind of engineer it myself a lot of the time, where you just see what's going on and try to contextualize it. And, you know, like, you know, when Ricky Fowler is coming down the stretch on the back nine at Phoenix, you know, what's the best story we can tell in this situation, you know, on the screen, whether it's in our highlight on Golf Central, or it's a note we can get to the guys in the tower, whatever it might be. So you're just kind of always, it's kind of a way to think about sports as you go, where you're kind of always looking for what's next, anticipating what might happen, and, you know, kind of sensing what's going to be most interesting. And then you just dig and dig and dig until you hit the end of the earth, basically. So the dirty secret about it, and I've had people make fun of me about it, is that, you know, I'll be in a production trailer working at the Masters or the U.S. Open, and I'll feel like I've seen about 10 shots the whole week, because I'm just constantly digging and looking things up. So that's a slight downside to it, is that maybe I don't always get to be in the moment, because I'm always, you know, looking for something new and trying to provide more context for people. But it's just kind of like a relentless digging process that, you know, it sounds really dorky to say, but I get great joy out of it. I love doing it, and I love finding the answers to stuff.
Do you ever get completely stumped? Like, do you have an example of something like you wanted to find out and could never do, or something that still just like eats at you that you can't figure out?
I wish we had more detailed statistics in major championships going back historically. They just got the shot tracker technology to the PGA Championship like 5 years ago. And, you know, you would love to know what Tiger's strokes gained putting was at Pebble Beach in 2000, where when he blew everyone away, or something like that. It's just numbers. There's just numbers that don't exist. So that can be frustrating at times. But, you know, that's kind of where that process comes in, to where, okay, we're at the Masters in 2017 with Sergio won, and I want to know the guys who have had X number of top tens before their first major win. I've got to create my own new tool to try to answer that question by making the that's the top tens and majors database thing I mentioned. So usually that kind of spurs more creativity. If I get stumped, then maybe, you know, I can come up with a way to answer the question. And usually it involves a lot of work and building my own tool to answer that question. But so in a weird way, I kind of like getting stumped, because it gets me into another thought process where I can, you know, dig deeper and try to come up with a way to answer the problem.
Do you have a favorite stat you've pulled, or favorite tweet of yours, where you're like, all right, that is my favorite thing I've ever accomplished in all of this statistical analysis?
You know, the crazy Tiger stuff always gets the most reaction, obviously, because, you know, he just crosses over every sport. And what's great about Tiger is that he's just so, his numbers are so absurdly dominant that you can keep coming up with ways to articulate how incredible he was at his peak. And there's really no end to it. I mean, it's amazing. The things that I still come up with stuff now, even after, you know, they used to make fun of me at ESPN. You know, a lot of times there's one golfer in the world, as we all know. So the joke with me was that I was the Tiger Woods researcher for a long time at ESPN. And I still come up with stuff. I'm like, wow, that's unbelievable. I had no idea. You come up with ways to articulate what he created. It's tough to say what tweet I might be most proud of, or what number I might be most proud of. I think anytime I work on something that gets picked up by people I respect, whether it's like Dan Hicks in the booth, or you guys, or like Kevin Van Valkenburg, or, you know, anybody in golf media who I really have a lot of who I really, you know, respect and admire, if they run with it, I mean, that's what I'm most proud of.
What out of all the people at Golf Channel, who picks your brain the most? Who wants, like, who goes to you for information to kind of formulate something they're going to say on TV, or kind of who makes you work the hardest?
Well, it's definitely Brandel.
I knew that was the answer. That's why I asked.
We love doing it. I love getting into a room with him, and he's got an idea about something, and I've got an idea about something, and, you know, Brandel is amazing. His work process is he has these yellow legal pads that are basically legendary at Golf Channel because he has this beautiful cursive handwriting, and it's just all over these legal pads, just like tattooed the entire, and it's just page after page after page, and it's stuff he's tracking and, you know, things he comes up with. And one of my favorite things when I was at Golf Channel was Brandel would have a thought and he would have a million words on his legal pad. And my job would be to talk to him and create something that we could turn from that into a graphic we could put on the screen during a breakdown, because you can't have 10 zillion characters on the screen. You know, you got to tell the story for the fans. So that was one of the things I loved the most working at Golf Channel was, you know, just being able to hang out and talk golf with those guys. It's unbelievable. People like David Duval and, you know, Frank Nobile has won all over the world. And, you know, Jim Gallagher Jr. is a great guy to hang out with. He won a tour championship, beat Seve in the Ryder Cup. Like, these are really accomplished pros and just, you know, in some cases, like David, these are like titans in their era.
Right.
And to just be able to sit there and kick it and talk about the sport we love and things that are happening, you can't put price on that.
Well, I did send you some homework because I wanted to kind of pick your brain on some of your favorite stats, but I didn't want to put you on the spot. We're going to get to some of those. But before we do, is there something you think like people get wrong about statistics in general, or something that you think that you wish you could hammer home to listeners or people that watch golf or, you know, are golfers that they don't really fully understand about the game?
Yeah, the joke that a lot of like my college buddies who don't work in TV make, or like somebody who's not real familiar with, be like, oh, yeah, so you can tell me who has the best par four scoring average when it's blowing wind 10 to 12 miles an hour on alternate Sundays. Like, they come up with some convoluted nonsense that's really specific. And, you know, I never want to do that. I want to tell what the story that's most important. You know, it's not just minutia for the sake of minutia. It's all part of the storytelling process. And the main thing I have to hammer home is that, you know, without accuracy, you really have nothing in this job. Mm-hmm. And you can lose your credibility really, really fast. I could come up with 200 incredible statistics, but I'm going to remember, and people are going to remember, the one I messed up. So I wouldn't call it pressure to always be accurate, but it is something that's incredibly valuable and important. And you can ruin a reputation really quick because people rely on your information. And if you get it wrong, I mean, you've got to own up to it and get better at it, because, you know, then if you lose your credibility, you know, it doesn't matter what you come up with. People aren't going to believe you.
Well, if you made an error, the tweet I would still think about first would be, I don't remember it exactly, but it was about counting the number of days in between, I think, 21-year-old winners of the Masters. Am I, is that jogging your memory?
Yeah.
I think it was like Seve.
It was Seve, Tiger, and Jordan, and it was like some insane parallel between, it was the Saturday of the 2014 Masters and Jordan was in the final pairing with Bubba. And yeah, no, I remember that. Yeah, that was pretty cool. Like, the BBC grabbed onto that, and
it was, yeah, this, the amount of days since there had been a 21-year-old winner was the same as the previous time in between 21-year-old winners. I'm like, dude, how do you, that was the one I was like, all right, what the hell does this database look like?
I mean, honestly, man, it's just, if you just keep mining and digging and going, eventually you come up with something like that. Mm-hmm. Like when Phil won in Mexico last year, it was a similar type of situation where Tiger was going to play at Bay Hill, and, you know, he hadn't won yet since he had come back. And it was the same thing. Like, it was like Phil went 1,487 days between wins. Sunday at Bay Hill will be 1,487 days between Tiger's wins, or something like that. Some insane coincidence. There's no way I could – you just happen to fall into it because you're immersed in it every day, and you keep digging and working hard, and then, you know, eventually you dig through the cave long enough and you find a diamond.
Hmm. All right, so let's get to some of the homework I gave you. And I don't know how many, I hope you have just a full database of your favorite Tiger Woods stats, but I asked you to accumulate your 10 favorite Tiger Woods stats. Do you have that for us?
I do, absolutely. I love pulling this together because I had to whittle it down from like 25.
Hey, so you could hit people with this. One thing I've learned, you can hit people with as much Tiger stuff as you care to, and they will keep coming back for more. I think you'll probably agree too. Like, I think the more we talk with, you know, pros and other people, it's that Tiger is somehow underrated in everything he's accomplished.
I've always said for years that, I mean, it's like going through the NBA record books now and seeing Wilt Chamberlain's name everywhere, and you're like, Wilt had a 50-30 season? You're like, how is that even possible? Like, we're going to go back and look at Tiger 25 years from now and be like, how did he do this? Like, this, he was playing another sport. So I've always kind of compared him to Will in that regard, because you just comb through like the NBA record books, and like the James Harden 30-point streak that ended the other night, he got to like 31. Well, he was only like 60 behind Will for the all-time number. Like, some ridiculous total, and that's really what Tiger's done to the PGA Tour record book.
All right, hit me with some.
Okay, number 10, I've got him in countdown format. From 2003 through 2005, Tiger had 1,543 putts from 3 feet and in. He missed 3 of them. The other thing, too, you were asking what one thing you would lay out to people. The way you present the information, too, can make a big impact. So if you just, if you say in a sentence like that, it can be more impactful than just, you know, listing it or what it might be. But
right, if you just say Tiger missed 3 putts over 3 years from inside 3 feet, doesn't mean as much as, yeah, he did it 1,500 times and only missed 3 of them.
Yeah, he was 1,540 for 1,543. Yeah.
That's absurd.
All right. Number 9. There are 8 PGA Tour seasons since 1983 in which a player beat the field average by 2.6 strokes per round. All 8 of those seasons belong to Tiger Woods.
Yep, that makes sense.
So basically the 8 best stroke differential seasons ever in this modern era where they have all the numbers, they all belong to Tiger.
I think along that line, I asked Mark Brody last year on the podcast his favorite Tiger stat or the most impressive Tiger stat. And he said at one point, Tiger beat the field average in strokes gained in 89 consecutive rounds.
Yeah, it's insane. It's absolutely mind-boggling. That was a great pod with Mark. All right, number 8. Tiger is the only player to win the U.S. Junior Amateur, U.S. Amateur, and the U.S. Open in his career. He won each 3 times.
Oh, my God.
Number 7. 16 rounds in the 16 rounds of the Tiger Slam, Tiger beat the field by an average of 5.4 strokes per round, which doing that once is incredible in a major. That was his average over the 16 rounds of the Tiger Slam. That means that during the Tiger Slam, he beat the field average by a combined total of more than 86 shots.
I think the Tiger Slam is somehow underappreciated or forgotten. Like, I feel like, one, that 2001 Masters was one of the best. I mean, it was Tiger and Phil and Duval coming down the stretch for the Tiger Slam, and it was truly biting nails all the way to the very end. And somehow, I don't feel like that accomplishment got the same appreciation that it should. One, because I remember being that age and thinking, well, I guess it doesn't really matter. He's going to win the next 3 anyways, and he's going to have the Tiger Slam and the Grand Slam. He's going to win 7 straight. But looking back at that, that is so absolutely absurd that he won 4 majors in a row.
Yeah, beating Peak Duval at that time in 2001 in that crucible with all that attention on him, and it was just like, it was just assumed that he was going to do it, and he did it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Nuts.
All right, number 6. Tiger during the 2000 season had 1 score worse than 73. It was in the first round of the Masters when he shot 75. He still beat the field average by more than half a shot that day.
And that, so that's probably what cost him the Grand Slam that year then.
Right, yeah. Basically it was. And he was still better than average. It was 1 round worse than 73 in the whole season.
That must have been just blustery as hell that day or something. Who won that 2000? Was that VJ?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Number 5, during a stretch from May of 99 through the end of 2000, Tiger played in 34 tournaments worldwide. He won 18 of them. In that span, he had 7 wins by 4 or more. He had 4 finishes outside the top 10. So he won 7 tournaments by 4 shots or more and finished outside the top 10 4 times in that span.
So he was more likely to win by more than 4 than finish outside the top 10.
Almost twice as likely to win by 4.
That's
or more.
Wonderful. Yeah. And somehow I still think like some of his Hank Haney years are even more impressive, which I think you're going to probably tap into at least some of that here in the coming facts.
Yeah, definitely. Number 4, Tiger has won 5 straight PGA Tour starts 3 different times. He's the only player in the last 60 years to do it once.
60 years?
Yeah. I think Hogan is the one before him.
I was going to say, who has even won like 3 straight starts?
That
was not on your homework list, but that would be maybe one to take home with you. That's like, I can't think of one over, you know, since... Yeah, I wouldn't even know where to guess on that.
I want to say Watson did it.
Okay.
But I mean, yeah. No, I didn't have that handy on my homework list, unfortunately. But yeah, if no one else in 60 years has done it at all, he did it 3 different times.
I think that was important for you, reputation wise, that people knew that you don't have all of this memorized. I think that's a good thing, and I think it's important for everyone to know.
You probably need to lock me up if I had all this.
Yes,
memorized.
That would be sick.
I think I'm really bad at memorizing things. I just, you know, kind of dig and keep going and know where to find stuff really quickly. So,
there you go.
You definitely need to institutionalize me if I knew all the stuff off the top of my head. Though I do have a buddy who I worked with at ESPN who can recite the final out of the World Series every year since like 1944 or something. It's insane Rain Man stuff, and I am not on that planet.
Weird flex, but okay.
Yeah, exactly. Number three, Tiger won 9 times in the 2000 PGA Tour season. No other player led after 9 rounds that year.
Yep, makes sense.
Number two, I love this fact, even though it's probably been heard several times, but the sentence itself is so absurd. Tiger has 40 European Tour wins, third most all time. He's never played on the European Tour. And I know people will be like, oh, but they count majors and WGCs. I'm like, yeah, that just means he won like half of those starts during that span. And he just did it so prolifically that he got to 40. It's ridiculous.
Third all time. Gosh. And Patrick Reed is a lifetime member of the European Tour. And
not Tiger.
And Tiger is not.
And number one, this one, it's numbers intensive, but I think it's crazy. It has to be the top one. From 97 through 2008, Tiger was 126 under par in majors. All right, there are 138 other players in that span with at least 40 rounds in majors. Of that group, second place is Joe Ogilvy at 63 over par.
Joe Ogilvy, not even Jeff?
Correct. Now, that speaks to the fact that Joe probably played like 40 to the minimum number of rounds of majors in that span.
Yeah.
But if you go the same amount of major rounds, Tiger is like more than 200 shots ahead of Phil and Ernie.
200 shots?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
126 under in majors, and that is nearly 200 better than anyone else with at least 40 rounds of majors in that span.
Oh, my God. And so that is...
just never having a bad round.
I'm trying to wrap my head around that too, and I think it's like I wonder what Nicklaus's numbers all would look like, because and we're gonna get to this with Tiger too. Like the latter half of your career, like you're gonna just like shoot higher numbers, and yeah, those totals are gonna creep up. But I just wonder kind of how that would have compared to Nicklaus like in his prime and whatnot. Because what's amazing about Tiger to me, one of the many things, I think he only has maybe 5 runner-ups in majors with 14 wins. And I mean,
correct.
People love to cite, I mean, it's well known that, you know, Jack had 19 runner-ups to go with his 18 wins, but also had like 17 third place finishes or something absurd like that. But when Tiger got close, he made sure.
One of my numbers later on.
It was it. Okay. I'm spoiling it. We're not done with the full David Letterman style here, but I don't know what that means. And Rory's kind of the same way. Like when Rory gets close at majors, he wins it. Like he doesn't have like a bunch of close calls, it seems like. I don't know what that means.
Right. Yeah, I don't have a great answer for that either. But the sheer consistency of Jack throughout the course of his career in those big events is mind-blowing. And like I said, I've got one of those later.
All right, so. Well, let's go right into that. What are some, I asked for your 5 favorite golf stats in general in the non-Tiger division?
So I've got a top 5 and an honorable mention.
Okay.
The honorable mention is, she hasn't played great golf recently, but Lydia Ko age stats are ridiculous. Mm-hmm. She won 10 LPGA tournaments before she turned 19. The previous record was Nancy Lopez to get to 10 wins at 22.
Oh, my God.
There are 8 LPGA wins all time. Just instances of it ever happening. There are 8 LPGA wins all time by players 17 or younger, and Lydia has 6 of them. So, I mean, just what she did at her age, absolutely incredible. And people forget how young. I think she's like, what, 22, 21, something like that now. So, you know. That what she did as a teenager is just completely unprecedented in this sport.
And that's what, I mean, without a doubt, and that's what, it's hard to really understand what really happened, you know, why that went away. I know she's made so many changes, but it also, you know, not to bring everything back to Tiger, but put into perspective, like not only did he burst onto the scene, but he maintained it for a really long time. And of course, he hasn't won a major in, you know, 11 years now, but he did this for such a long period of time that's so hard to maintain this top level. We see guys, I mean, DJ has been on a 3-year run of, I think he's won 11 times in the last 3 years. But Jason right. Day had his like 18-month run, but then it went away. And like Justin Rose has had an incredible run as well, but just no one can really sustain it for a really notably long period of time.
Tiger's number one in the world for more than 13 years. That's not counting when he was like 2 or 3, like right behind Vijay or Ernie or whoever. That's just as number one for 13 years. Like his prime was, that's 97 to to 08, and then you throw in 12 and 13 a little bit too. I mean, it's absolutely incredible.
Well, and along the same things, you know, age is very different on the LPGA tour. But I was looking, you know, we did a podcast with Annika Sorenstam a couple of weeks ago, and she won, I forget now, I think 10 majors, whatever it was. And she didn't win her first one until she was 24 years old. And that's the same age as Michelle Wee was when she won her first major. And that was like, finally, she's won a major. Yeah,
she broke through.
Yeah. And so it's...
She can't rent a car yet.
Yeah. And so, like, you know, people are really quick to rush to judgment, I think, on, like, Ricky Fowler. And, you know, say he's never won... you know, if he doesn't win a major now, he's never going to win one. It's like, he's 30. He's like, all right, guys, like... I know we did this with Phil, but Phil was 33 years old when he won his first major. And so it's, I don't know. I hate when people give, and I'm kind of all over the place here, but I hate when people are like, you know, Aaron Baddeley has the same amount of wins as you know, Ricky Fowler. It's like, guys, comparing to people his own age, at least, I mean, the guy's not even halfway probably through his career. He's got a lot ahead of him.
And Tiger spoiled us, and then I've got a mention of him later, but Jordan Spieth spoiled us too with his young success. Mm-hmm. So what Ricky's done at his age is pretty commendable. I know that people want him to do more, but I mean, he's got a lot of time. Like, he's only 30 years old. So
correct.
All right, number five on my five favorite non-Tiger golf statistics. I don't think people realize how tough it is to convert 54-hole leads on the PGA Tour.
Yes.
Players with a 1, 2, or 3-shot lead, so 1 shot, 2 shot, 3 shots, they win 33% of the time over the last 6 years. I mean, it is so hard to close a lead. So the label of somebody choking, or even, like, you know, Rory being in the final pairing last week in Mexico, I mean, he's still four back. It's really, I mean, it's so tough to win one of these elite golf tournaments. And I don't think people, you know, I don't think they realize that. If you take the number down to just 1 shot since 2013, it's 26% of the time players convert.
Jeez. That's what I love following. I think it's Ken Palm Golf or Ken Pomeroy Golf Odds. I think it's just a computer that tweets the stats out. But as things go along, I mean, it'll show you your percentage chance of winning, like when you tee off. So, like, Rory tees off with a 1-shot lead. It still might show it, depending on how many guys are close to him and how many shots back, obviously. It shows.
And who's close to him.
Yes, exactly. It's like, yeah, he's got a 17% chance of winning right now or something like that. It's like, wait a second here. That is so different than how it's presented. Of he's 0 for, you know, he's only closed 2 of his 6 54-hole leads. Like, actually, that's, like, pretty good percentage.
That's on par.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, unless it was a 5 or 6 shot lead. What's kind of crazy is that when I made the 54 leader database on tour, when you get to 4 shots, it astronomically jumps into, like, the 80% range. Now, I know we're a few weeks ago, JT blew a 4-shot lead, but I don't know if that speaks to the elite level of player who can get to a 4-shot lead through 54 holes and a combination of that. And obviously, he's got that much of a gap. But 1, 2, or 3 shots since 2013 is just 33% of the time.
Well, and that's where, Tiger kind of screwed things up for us, and that his numbers looked like Mariano Rivera in his prime closing tournaments out and kind of screwed up what we thought was a normal percentage of conversion of 54-hole leads, probably.
I think Tiger's 46 for 48 with an outright 54-hole lead.
Are you serious?
Which is, yeah.
Well, I thought he had given away more PGA
Tour. A couple times he was tied for the lead.
Okay.
But yeah, I think I'm pretty sure it's 46 for 48 after East Lake last year.
And just the one major that he had the lead and didn't win, correct? 09 PGA, I think.
Correct. Yep. Correct. Number four, nobody has ever won the Players in back-to-back years. Only two. Yeah. And I think this is fascinating. Only two defending champions at Sawgrass have ever even finished in the top five. So why this has never happened on that golf course. We did a feature about it last year for Live from the Players and asked a bunch of players about it, and they were all kind of stumped by it too. I don't know if it speaks to the kind of equal test that Sawgrass can be, or, you know, there's been all kinds of different winners at the Players from, I mean, Fred Funk and, you know, Adam Scott won in a span of 3 years, you know. So I've always been interested by the fact that, yeah, they've never had a back-to-back winner there.
That's interesting. Yeah, there's no real, like, I guess, horse for course. You know, we see it every year. It's such a highly emphasized tournament, and we're never like, oh, he plays really well at Sawgrass. Like, no one, and we never say that really about anyone. That is interesting. Phil won there, and it couldn't. What did he say a couple years ago? Like, I can't believe I ever won here.
I can't believe I won on this golf course. Yeah, it's one of the, so every big event, and even, like, week to week, I'll do, best scoring average on this court's last 5 years or since 2010 or whatever it might be. The players is the only one where there's never a guy who's in the 60s over the last five years. It's always 70, 70 and a half, 71. And that's the guy with the best scoring average in that span. It's pretty incredible. Also, side note to that, Colonial has not had a back-to-back winner since 1952, 1953, which I think is really interesting because we always pick Colonial's always the one we go to. Oh, that's a Corsac. Johnson can win on, or Jim Furyk can win on, but they haven't had a back. It seemed to fit a style of player, in our minds, but they haven't had a back-to-back winner in almost 70 years.
So are we safe to say, and I'm sure you don't have this handy, but like for most PGA Tour events, we've had back-to-back winners at pretty much all of them since then?
Well, definitely all the ones Tiger's played. But even like Pebble Beach has had a handful of them. Usually you'll find guys who've won back to back. But I guess on tougher courses, it's harder to find. Like this week at the Honda, Jack's the only guy. It wasn't at PGA National, but Jack's the only guy to win that tournament back to back years. And it's always been on for the most part, a pretty difficult course. So it's just always been interesting to me when you dig for trends and you find that, at a place like that, nobody's ever done it back to back.
Is Matt Every at Bay Hill the last guy to go back to back at a PGA Tour event? I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I don't know if you have that handy. I doubt it, but that's the last one. That may be the best back to back win of all time.
Most incredibly unpredictable one.
Correct.
That's for sure. Koepka, U.S. Open.
Oh God, that's right. Maybe Koepka's kind of onto something about being forgotten about.
anytime it's a major, it's in a different venue.
Yeah, that's true.
It doesn't feel the same. Brendan Steele won Safeway back to back years too, 16 and
that's
17.
That's right. You're right.
I did not have that handy. I found that quickly. That's an example of what you've got to do if, let's say, you're in a commercial break and Ryan Burr says, "Who's the last guy to win this tournament back to back?" and you've got 11 seconds to answer it. So
that's a symptom of the sickness right there. That's what you just displayed.
Yeah, but truthfully too, it is a sickness. That's the fun thing to me. I get a rush out of that. So
awesome.
Anyway, yeah. All right. Number three, we're going to the Ryder Cup. The last four Ryder Cups on European soil. So this is 06, 10, 14, and 18. American players ranked in the top 10 in the world at the time have a combined match record of 24, 42, and 6. So the top 10 players in the world for the U.S., last four Ryder Cups in European soil, that's how bad they've been.
I love that you included 06, because I can't tell you how many times the 06 Ryder Cup has come up on this podcast. I think that...
I know, that bird.
that was Tiger, Phil, and Furyk were 1, 2, and 3 in the world, I think. And I think maybe they won like two matches between all of them at that point. But
definitely impacts that number. Yeah.
At a certain point, it's like, all right, if our guys ranked in the top 10 aren't winning matches, then like, what are we actually trying to figure out? You just got to go out and play some golf at a certain point.
Yeah, it seems like a pretty easy equation to solve.
Yeah.
Dustin Johnson at Paris, win some matches, and maybe it'll be different.
You've made the full convert to 15th Club here, pulling just European site Ryder Cups there. That's well done.
That's my only – I'm not anti-American, obviously, but that's my only negative U.S. Ryder Cup stat I have.
There's probably more if you keep picking at that one, but yeah,
well,
continue.
I've only had this job for about 30 hours.
That's
so
right.
There's still time. My number two is Jack's ridiculous consistency in the majors.
Mm-hmm.
So Jack has 73 top 10s in the majors.
Yep.
73. Since the first Masters was held in 34, that's 25 more than anyone else. Sam Snead is second with 48. So to put that in perspective, the following players have less than 25 top 10s in majors in their careers. Billy Casper, Vijay Singh, Lee Trevino, Hale Irwin. So basically it's Jack... Yeah, his top 10s are equivalent to Sam Snead plus Billy Casper.
And I definitely don't want to take away from anything that Jack accomplished, but it is a symptom of a different era in that there just was not the same depth. And he would probably tell you, like, if I played an average, if I played very average at a major, I maybe fell out of the top 10.
Yeah.
Yeah. What did he go with? I think it's like 36 for 40 in the 70s, finishing the top 10 in majors.
Right, he had more wins than finishes outside the top 10.
It's just
insane.
Absurd.
Yeah. I think you're going to like my number one.
Okay.
So there's a player that is a fan favorite, flashy, flamboyant, burned out quickly, and we've all been searching for him ever since. And every once in a while, when I dig through numbers, I find an Anthony Kim piece of gold. And there's a buddy I work with at Golf Channel who I always text him when I find it because he gets the biggest kick out of it. So over the last 40 years, there are more than 300 players with at least 10 rounds at the Masters.
Okay.
Four players have gained 1.8 strokes or more per round on the field in that group over the last 40 years. Those players are Jordan Spieth, Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson, and Anthony Kim.
Oh, my God.
No. It just makes Sweet you yearn for that day when he made, was it 9 birdies or 10 birdies? It was some unbelievable run.
I think he made 11 birdies one year.
It was 11. Yeah, I think it was 11. You're right.
He only shot like 63, I think, with it. Or he had a double or something like that. I'd have to look that one up.
That's more reason to love the guy.
Yeah, seriously. He might be the original Icarito. He flew too close to the sun. And I think he actually touched it and melted back and came back to Earth. Man, we miss that guy. We're gonna figure something out on that front. We're trying so hard to get him on the podcast. One of these days, we're going to just force our way in the door and get it done. I'm not going to promise, but I have a good feeling.
I'm going to listen to it the moment you tweet it, then when that happens. I mean, my dad played golf for Oklahoma, so I've got a little bit of a, you know, I rooted for him really hard. When he came out, I mean, my two favorite players at that time, since like 07, 08, 09, Tiger and Anthony Kim. Those are the guys I root for. So
yep.
I every once in a while, I'll fall into like most wins before 26 since X, and like Anthony Kim's at the bottom of the graphic. So
don't break my heart like that. I don't need I'm gonna just start pacing around the room here pretty shortly.
I just love falling into the finding AK on one of those lists every once in a while.
Is there a player that you think doesn't get the respect they deserve, like in your opinion? We may have already, they might even be Tiger for all we've talked about him, but is there anybody that sticks out to you?
I think the guy who's at the top of the sport now that kind of fits that bill is Justin Thomas.
Yeah.
He spent the first few years of his career in Jordan Spieth. I don't know if you've ever seen the photo of them at the Junior Ryder Cup eating a hamburger. You know?
Was that one, the one in France? I feel like I saw that a few years ago.
I've never seen that before. I think we put a moratorium on that photo like 9 months ago at golf. Okay, we get it. We're not showing it anymore. And the truth is, like, he's going to end up in the shadow of him in record books too. You know, Thomas, if he would have won at Riviera, he would have been, it would have been just over the last 60 years, guys to get to 10 wins at his age, Tiger, Jack, Spieth, and JT. So it would have just been Tiger, Jack, and JT, but Jordan did it right before him. And he's always going to be associated with Jordan. And I think that lessens a little bit the kind of how we view what he's accomplished at such a young age. So he definitely fits that mold for me.
Interesting. And you must have had that one ready to go if he won, and he didn't win, so you just had to jam that one in somewhere, huh?
Yeah, had it ready. It took a lot of digging at Phoenix, so you got to go back six decades, and you know he was in contention there. So, yeah.
Do you have a most random stat you've ever pulled out of your ass?
It's always kind of circumstantial, and you know when something is happening, and you figure, all right, this guy's gonna be the first since Tiger or Jack or you know Phil or somebody like that. But like a few weeks ago, Cameron Champ was contending in Maui. I think it was Friday. And so if he would have won that week, I've got to look way ahead. I know it's Friday and you can't win the tournament that day. But if it's some big note, it's going to take me a long time. You know, I got to find it a couple days in advance. So I wanted to find, all right, who's the last guy to win twice in his first 13 career starts? And you're thinking, oh, it's probably going to be Tiger, you know, maybe going further back, maybe it's Jack. And then you dig through it and you find out the last guy to do that is Robert Gomez.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, exactly. So you assume you're going to come up with this, you know, big, you know, enormous historic name, and it's Robert Gomez. Another one was from recently, DJ at Shinnecock. He led by 4 after the second round. And so that Friday night, I'm thinking, all right, who's the last guy to lose a 4-shot, 36-hole lead in the U.S. Open? And you think, oh, man, Arnold Palmer must have done it at one point, or you know, maybe Sam Snead one of the times he was runner-up. No, it's Tom McNamara, 1908.
Oh, my
so
God.
So, I love you. You'll, it's always kind of in the moment, and like I said, circumstantial, but you'll pluck out some name, and you're like, yeah, nah, I had no idea, you know? So, that's – I mean, last week I tweeted that what was the name of the guy that won on the web.com tour? Oh,
was it Martin Trainer? The one?
Yeah, Martin Trainer. Yeah,
that was Puerto Rico. Yeah,
Puerto Rico. Yeah, his great great grandfather invented the cotton gin.
Where did you find that?
So the way that is total luck to come up with something like that. Like we'll have in the show that, all right, we're going to do a Martin Trainer career notes out of the highlight of his win in Puerto Rico. I'm really sorry that I said web.com tour, Martin. It was a PGA Tour win, absolutely. Yes. I did not mean that. But we're going to do a graphic on career notes. And so you're looking through like bio information on the PGA Tour. And you're like, oh, okay, has his dad played professional basketball in France? That's cool. We'll get that on the graphic. Won twice in the web.com tour last year. And there's like a blurb somewhere in there. Great, great grandfather invented the cotton gin. And you're like, what? So it's really just kind of happenstance to come up with that. And yeah. Like I said, you keep mining and digging, and eventually you find some absurd note like that.
Wow. All right, we're going to get a few more stats out of you, then we're going to let you out of here. But I gave you three guys that I wanted to learn more about, or something that I don't know about, or the listeners might not know. So tell me something about Rory that I don't know.
So I don't think his accomplishments at his age have been celebrated enough. I know I've harped on age and wins and stuff talking to you today, but I mean, there's just so many guys who've done so many incredible things at such a young age recently that, you know, I don't think we've celebrated Rory enough. The only guys with four majors before the age of 26 in the last 100 years are Bobby Jones, Jack Nicklaus, Tiger Woods, and Rory McIlroy. Mm. I mean, that's what he did at that young of an age, four majors before 26. I want to do a good and a bad. So that was the good. The bad, so Rory, he's been in the top six in scoring average on the PGA Tour each of the last 5 years. But in that same span, his strokes gained approach rank has dropped every year, with 12th to 23rd to 29th, 48th, 56th last season. So he's by no means a bad iron player, but I think that's just a testament to how remarkable his driving is.
I was going to say,
he's able to still be an elite scorer with his iron play diminishing year by year.
Man, it's so refreshing to have you here talking to me. The last podcast we recorded, I had to answer questions as to whether or not Rory was dead. That was the question that was asked. And I had to say that, you know, Rory is leading the this. So we're recording this before the end of Honda. This is going to go up after Honda. But he's leading the tour in strokes gain total for the year. And I had to convince, you know, convince the guys around me that that was a good thing somehow. So you're welcome to come back anytime.
I'll back you up whenever you need it, man. So, I mean, look, he's had a really accomplished career so far. This is the first time he's had four straight top five finishes. I know with Rory, the barometer is win or it's a failure sometimes. And I think that maybe he's a victim of his own success in that regard.
That's what I was going to say. I wish I would have said this last week on the podcast, was if Tiger had come out with four straight top fives this year, think of how excited we would have been about it. You know what I mean?
But they'd be blasting fireworks off the top of Golf Channel at the top of every hour.
Exactly. It's like, all right, let's get excited about it. And I know why it feels frustrating. We just feel like Rory should have this gear that he can enter into and win, you know, tournaments, and hasn't done it in recent years. But I think, man, I'd much rather be in Rory's shoes right now than the next guy we're going to talk about. I was going to say, tell me something about Jordan Spieth that I don't know.
All right, I got another good and bad for him. Okay. I want to talk about how unbelievable the start of his Masters career is. He's the only guy in the history of the Masters with four top three finishes in his first five career starts. Jack didn't do it. Tiger didn't do it. Sarah's and Watson, name a guy. They didn't do it. He's the only one with four top threes through five starts. So through 20 career Masters rounds, Tiger had gained 37 strokes on the field collectively. That's total, not per round. Mm-hmm. 37. Jordan has gained 65.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. That is how unbelievable the beginning of his Masters career has been.
Well, I got tired of updating it because I always screwed the math up. But, like, his record against the field was 376 and four or something like that through right. through yeah. 4 years or something. Like, he'd only been beat by a couple guys in the span of 4 years, which is just absolutely nuts. But I'm afraid to hear what the bad one is.
So we all harp on his putting. I know on the last podcast you listed the putts he missed, I think, on his second nine on Sunday mm-hmm. at Mexico, and it was a horror show. His putting is not good, but it's not his biggest issue. He's 116th in strokes gained putting. That's, like you said, it's entering the Honda. But he's 172nd in strokes gained tee to green.
Right.
When he won the Open 2 years ago, he was second in strokes gained approach. He's 113th right now. So that narrative, I don't know if it's because we saw him make so many big putts in big moments when he was at the top of his game, but the narrative that it's his putting that's completely letting him down. Look, it's not good, but and it's easy to clip together a string of putts that he's emotive about after they don't go in. But statistically speaking, it's his iron play that's dropped off more.
Yeah, I mean, I was screaming it from the rooftops back then that, you know, even that year that he let the Masters get away, everyone's like, his ball striking's been so bad. And he was like leading the field in strokes gained approach for the week or something like that. It's like,
I don't know if it's because like we think he's some diminutive guy.
I so know.
I just don't understand where that narrative comes from, which, by the way, if you stay next to him in person, like he's solid 6 feet tall. Like he's not a tiny guy. Yeah. So
he's way bigger than Rory.
Yeah. I don't know if that perception feeds into that or what it is, but it's his iron play so far this season that's let him down.
Yeah. I mean, he was one of the best ball strikers in the world. He just wasn't the super long bomber, or he still isn't. But now that ball striking has come crashing back to earth. And on top of that, I feel, I don't know who's to say, but he might be pressing a bit with the putter. And there does appear to be issues there. But yeah, if you don't get it on the green and get it close anyways, it's not going to matter much.
Correct.
All right. Tell me something about Dustin Johnson that maybe I don't know.
So we all know he's amazing tee to green, but I think it's actually underappreciated how good he is. Last season, he played 15 tournaments where strokes gained tee to green was measured all four routes. He never ranked outside the top 25 in that statistic in an individual event.
He never so bombs even his, out, yeah.
Even his bad weeks tee to green, he was still gaining more than a shot per round on the field tee to green. I mean, that's unbelievable. If you're that consistent of a ball striker – I mean, he goes out there with his C game ball striking, and he's still better than the field.
There's something I think about with Dustin more often than it honestly kind of changed my perception of him. I mean, I know we kind of view him as this robot and no emotion. And we all saw his fist pump after he won Mexico. It was almost like, what am I supposed to do here? Oh, I'm supposed to fist pump. That's right. And you kind of think he doesn't care. I remember when I was in Abu Dhabi, he clearly had gotten an appearance fee to play in Abu Dhabi, and I was out following him and Rory, and I think maybe Fleetwood was with him. Mm-hmm. And they made the turn, and I think he's on the first hole. I think it was their second nine. And he hit like a very average chip, and he kind of is kind of near me, and he just under his breath, it's like, and he's just like grunting under his breath. Wow. And it was very like he was very upset about that chip that he had just hit, and he wasn't playing poorly, but I was just like, oh, like maybe there is like more to like his grind than people really fully appreciate. And if you look at his numbers, how he, like you just mentioned, he doesn't bottom out. Like he doesn't
at all.
I forget where I heard this stat that somewhat recently about how he doesn't miss cuts. Like he hasn't missed cuts in the last, however many cuts he's missed in the last several years would shock you. I don't know what that number is, but it's not, he's not like this crazy high, crazy low guy, bomb and gouge, wild, all over the place guy. He's incredibly long, incredibly accurate, and so unbelievably skilled that it's like it's time for that to really start translating into majors.
Yeah, he has 5 missed cuts worldwide since the beginning of 2016.
That's absurd. That's crazy.
In that span, yeah, he has 12 wins.
And we, again, Tiger has ruined what missed cuts mean. You know what I mean? It's like he missed 15 or so in his career. So that, you know,
most of them are in the last couple of years.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's just an alien number. It's wilt. Like I said, I mean, you know, distorted everything.
Was there a good and bad with DJ or only good?
No, I only had good.
Okay, good.
And then he's one of the only two guys in the last 35 years or so have led in a season in par 3, par 4, and par 5 scoring, which I think we could call that golf's triple crown like they do in baseball.
Oh, I like that.
The only other guy to do that is Tiger, and he did it twice.
Yep.
So even when you do a great DJ stat, you work it in. Ah, Tiger did it
twice.
Yeah,
Tiger's already done that. It's like any TV show. Oh, Simpsons have already done that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
We may have covered this one. Most historically underrated player?
My favorite, I've got a from the men's side, from the women's side. From the women's side, I think Paige Zaharias is one of the most underrated athletes in history.
All right.
She won 2 Olympic gold medals in track and field and 10 LPGA majors. I mean,
that's absurd.
She played in men's professional golf events in the 30s. I mean, this is so far before her time. She was so beloved. She was up there in terms of popularity with, like, in her day in the 40s with, you know, the big Yankees of the time. Like, she was a star. And the fact that she won it's kind of gross, but she won a U.S. Open, U.S. Women's Open, after beating cancer, wearing a colostomy bag.
Oh, like, my God.
I encourage anybody to read. I'm a little biased. She's a Texas hero. I'm from the great state of Texas, but I love Paige Zaharias. Her accomplishments on and off, on the course and in other sports, are crazy. She pitched in, like, minor league baseball games. Like, she is an unbelievable story. So I encourage anybody to read up about her. On the men's side, I think Bobby Locke is historically one of the most underrated players. He won a PGA Tour event by 16 shots and then was essentially banned from the tour.
Why?
He was too good.
Really?
I mean, I've had this conversation with Brandel for years. I mean, we read into it, and like, there's quotes from like Claude Harmon, who was the Masters champion, unsolicited, saying, "Yeah, basically Bobby Locke's been banned from the tour." And you know, there were publicly there were other reasons for it. I don't know all the specifics, but when the ban was eventually lifted years later, Locke just chose not to play in the United States. And I think that if they had allowed him to play his career in the U.S. and circumstances had worked out differently, we would talk about him historically in a completely different way.
Man, wow. You brought the heat today. I'll give you that.
Thanks, man.
I forget if I sent you. Did I ask for five more fun ones?
I do have a few more fun ones.
A few more fun ones, and then we'll let you out of here.
All right. Jason Day in 2015 was ridiculous, and we didn't celebrate it enough at the time. He averaged 4.71 birdies per round, the only player with more per round in a season the last 30 years, 2000 Tiger Woods.
Oh my God.
That's how good Jason Day was in 2015. Like, he won the Canadian Open July through September, won the Canadian Open, won the PGA by three, and then two playoff events by six and six shots. I mean, he had an unbelievable year. And, of course, he was player of the year and everything. But historically, we're going to look back and say, man, his peak is otherworldly.
Tiger only beat that number one time?
Yes.
Whoa.
Correct.
Anytime you could say that, yeah, Tiger only got it one time. It's like, whoa, okay, that is special. All right, that's a good one.
Ricky's heartbreak, I wrote in my notes, Ricky's heartbreak index in the majors is astronomical. Since the first Masters in 1934, only three players have more top fives in majors without a win than Ricky does. That sounds bad. I mean, that he's gotten that close that often. And then you look at Lee Westwood, a guy who's been one of my favorite players for the last 20 years. He has the most top fives in the modern era of anyone without a win. He has 11 top fives in majors and doesn't have a win. Just an unbelievable collection of, I mean, he was, one of them was the U.S. Open at Torrey Pines, the Tiger won, and even recently as a few years ago when Danny Willett won the Masters, he was right there after Jordan collapsed. Just an unbelievable string of accomplishments in his career and got so close so often in majors, and it's just never broken through.
Yeah, and I've said it a million times on here. I hate when people make that out to be a bad thing in someone's career. Like, they've been so close.
It's a testament to how great you are.
Yeah.
I totally think that. I think the same thing with, I said heartbreak index, but that's a testament to how great Ricky is.
Correct.
The fact that he keeps putting himself in that position time after time.
Yep. All right. Three more.
Okay. We've had a really unprecedented run of elite players winning majors. 28 straight major champions have been ranked in the top 50, which is crazy.
Wow.
We usually, I mean, to put that in perspective, from 09 to 2011, right before that run started, half of the major winners were ranked outside the top 50. That was like Keegan Bradley, Darren Clark, that run of major champions, Wei Yang, of guys who were outside the top 50 of the world. We've had 28 straight. Like, the lowest ranked major winner in that span, I think, is Jimmy Walker. When he won the PGA, he was like in the 40s. But Jimmy had won like five times on the PGA Tour in recent years when he'd done that. So, I mean, it's a I always go to a major now thinking, man, we're really due for,
that's
like,
exactly. We got a group text and we're like, oh, we're due for for Aaron Baddeley to win this. God, that's twice I've referenced Aaron Baddeley. But yeah, we're due we're due for so-and-so to win a major, aren't we, this week? And it just keeps not happening. It's really,
I know.
It's a testament.
Especially when we've got three straight opportunities for someone to complete a Grand Slam. You know that it's gonna be, I mean,
yeah.
Molinari wasn't really a dud. I mean, he had played elite golf.
Right, correct.
He's fun to watch, too. But we're kind of due for a
Ben Curtis.
A Ben Curtis, yeah.
Yeah.
a Todd Hamilton.
Yes.
Somebody we haven't had one of those in so long. We've been really fortunate for that.
Correct. All right.
Okay. Every year, for the last 4 years, I've picked Justin Rose to win the Masters. And because all his trends point to him doing it. He has the second most strokes gained against the field in the Masters the last 5 years. Only Jordan Spieth has more. So I'm going to do what I normally do going into Augusta, dig through all the numbers, and I'm going to land at Rose and Rory, the only guy who's been in the top 10 each of the last 5 years. And I'm just going to, be frustrated that that's what I come to the conclusion to, because I end up doing that every year going into Augusta.
It is time. I was getting ready to say out loud, like, if I didn't lock in Spieth as my pick, now would be a good time to bail. I'm still not going to, but if I wasn't going to, it's like, I'm going to pick Justin Rose. Then I remembered he's ranked number one in the world, and then, like, that's not that bold of a call anymore. But
no, not at all. Especially, like, he's sneaky, is really consistent at Augusta.
Correct.
He doesn't, I guess we don't put him in that same, like, he wasn't in contention that crazy Sunday last year. When Jordan won by a million, he was tied for second with Phil. So I don't know, if maybe we just don't look at him in that way, but his numbers point to it.
Correct.
And my last one is going to be Tiger, Tiger, like the last few weeks.
Wouldn't have it any other way.
All right. So you guys talked about, and this is a point Brandel was making and you addressed on the last podcast, like his approach has been really conservative on par fours and par fives. The PGA Tour has a stat called percentage of distance covered by tee shots. So basically, how much on par fours and par fives, how much of the hole are you taking out of play, distance wise with your tee shot? Tiger's 186 in that statistic. And the guys that are around him on that statistic are like Ryan Gay, guys with much slower club head speed. Tiger's 35th in club head speed, and he's 186th in the percentage of distance covered in tee shots. So, I mean, he's playing back and trying to compete with the best part of his game. He's second in strokes gained approach this season. He was third last season. There's reality based in that, you know, that theory that he's playing conservatively, and it's, you know, leaving him with longer approach shots than others. And even though he's doing that, he's so good with his irons, he's still second on the tour in strokes gained approach.
There you have it. I mean, that's so I'm actually okay with it. I feel like for years, and I said this last week, like we've been yelling at him to put the driver away. And if he actually listens and gets on and plays well, I think that lowers his ceiling a little bit, of course. But if he truly has not driven the ball great, I know he's actually when he's pulled driver, he's actually driven it pretty well this year. But he's historically not a great driver of the ball, and we want him to be in play so he can hit irons on the green, make a ton of pars, and sneak some birdies in there. Like, he's going to be competitive playing like that. Yeah, so
absolutely. And to that point, when he won at East Lake, he was 23rd out of 30 players in that percentage of distance
there you
covered
go.
By tee shots.
Yeah, and so. The worst thing he could do is try to keep up with DJ and Rory and trying to cut the same dog legs as they are. I think he knows that. I don't think he has that kind of pride or ego that goes with the driver anymore, and I think that's kind of a big step he's taken the last few years. So,
completely agree.
Awesome. Jay Ray, thank you a ton for all the background on everything you've done and for bringing the heat on the fun stats, and keep up the great work on Twitter. Is your Twitter account changing? What is your Twitter account?
It's just Justin Ray Golf now. We took GC off and made it golf.
All right, Justin Ray Golf. I'm sure most people here are already following that. But if you're not, please follow that. He is one of the best follows on Twitter. So, Justin, thank you for taking the time, for coming on, and for all you do for the world of golf.
Thank you, brother. You too.
Cheers.
Get the right club. Be the right club today.
Yes! Johnny, that's better than most.
How about in?
That is better than most. Better than most!